CliffCentral.com.
Oh, yes, it's called Stay Woke. It's Muller Vegas. It is Tuesday morning, already deep into October the 8th, if you're watching the calendar for some reason, and I think a lot of people are. It's that time of year where we get excited about the fact that we've got some holidays coming up, the weather's good. It's nice. It is nice. And we're starting to see some things happen. I saw an interesting Daily Maverick story yesterday about all the people who have been thrown out over the last couple of months. And I know Pumi and I are at very best skeptical of Cyril and his administration. But there are a bunch of people who are no longer part of the mess. And people like Natim Tetwa being forced now to actually account for themselves.
Dude, did you see Vatis? So now you see. Did you see Vatiswa's letter?
Mm.
My favorite response of like the people, because Nati responded acknowledging that he'd seen the letter, obviously because of how much hype it got during the course of the day.
This is Vatiswa Ndaga, the actress who tweeted the Minister of Arts and Culture saying actors and actresses need to be
compensated,
better taken care of in this country. Yeah.
And kind of residuals, which is the big thing about that, because what the contract, a lot of people were kind of, what's a global contract? A global contract means everything. You have basically at the end of the 5 weeks given over your image, your rights, your in perpetuity across the world and every territory.
This is a question of the media businesses need to be reasonable. Do you really want government getting involved in this? We've seen how well the Department of Arts and Culture has done everything else. Do we really want him to take care of this stuff?
But so somebody tweeted, "We're waiting to see what you're going to do, Minister of Condolences and Congratulations."
Because
he's always tweeting condolences.
That is all he's doing. All right. Stili Charalambos is the Daily Maverick's big boss. He's been, he was the founder along with Branko. He's been there from the very get-go, and he's really shepherded the Daily Maverick through some extraordinary things. The collapse and decline of mainstream media, the way that standard newspapers have kind of disappeared to the very periphery of our what would you even call it? Our consciousness. I mean, I don't know a lot of people who still read the newspaper. They go online or they get it from the Daily Maverick on email. And that's what people are doing. When you guys started this, Stili, so many years ago, could you have foreseen this happening in 10 years?
Personally, no, because I knew absolutely nothing about the media industry back then, and I was a newbie, and I was really just coming along for the ride and just trying not to look stupid for the first couple of years and just trying to learn as much as I could.
Well, congrats on 10 years.
Well, thank you.
And it's nice to have you back in the studio.
It's great to be back. Same in the old studio. Brings back some memories and some my public speaking anxiety as well. Yeah, 10 years. It's like it's 10 years in October, end of October.
Sure.
That's like 70 years in human years, I think, in digital media startup. So it's been an adventure, a trip. It's been a challenge. It's been a mountain climb. It's been therapy sessions. It's been everything.
Yeah, because
you can have in a
obviously
drama.
Obviously, there have been bumpy roads and there have been very, very difficult times where really – you guys were keeping it going despite the fact that everyone was saying to you were madmen. What do you remember from those very early days?
Well, I mean, the struggle is real, and it's been actually one long perpetual struggle. So we've only ever known basically a wartime experience. And now that other media are starting to feel that and really feel that, you can see how they're reacting, and it's difficult when you come from a place of, you know, comfort or complacency, and then you have to deal with all these existential threats. It's been interesting to see how some people have reacted or not reacted.
But you guys have been battle hardened, so you might be forgiven for taking just a little bit of pleasure in their sudden paranoia.
Look, we were forged in the fire of being born into a digital media startup in the age of Google and Facebook in the Zoom administration in this country.
It was like the planets didn't align, especially for you.
Absolutely. So do I take pleasure in it? You know, only for half a second, and then you realize it's not good for the industry. It's not good for journalism as a whole. And then, you know, I kind of just check my schadenfreude and put it away and go, actually, this isn't good. And it's not good for anyone. So,
yeah, well, who are your early supporters and who were your early detractors, and what's happened to them?
Early supporters were, you know, Branko had come from Maverick Magazine and a long career in publishing before that, and left Yugoslavia and came to South Africa and then got into, you know, continued his publishing here. So he had built up a fan base, he had built up some friends and a network and a group of about 200 beta testers of the site.
Yeah.
And we launched with those guys, basically. Sure. And so those were our supporters, and then there were some people who helped with seed funding along the way, and the detractors. Well, the list isn't long enough for this show, so I mean, we don't have enough time in the show to go through all the detractors.
Have any of those detractors ever said to you, hey, you know what, I wasn't a supporter of you guys in the beginning because I didn't get it, but now I am, and well done?
Yeah,
some of them come around, and
yeah, some of them have come around. And there was an interesting sort of tirade by Peter Bruce recently, mm-hmm. where he had a full-on go at us and Branko for about three or four pieces, and then finally the fourth piece, the last one, was that ultimately he acknowledges that we are their biggest threat, and that his genius is the result of of where they are today, you know, which was a big about turn in a short space of time, which was very interesting. But so I mean, I guess that could be someone who sort of come around and in a way acknowledged our impact on the industry. And I mean, we don't really, you know, pay too much attention to what other people say about us. We just do what we do, and we just keep our, you know, put our heads down and just keep doing it. And if we feel that's the way to go, then we'll do that, and rely on our sort of stubbornness and creativity to get us where we need to go.
There are people who are talking a lot about how news media should look and feel and how it will survive going into this era of, you know, the abundance of free information, but not necessarily true information. And we're in the era of fake news. And a lot of people say that when you commoditize news media, sometimes that has the effect of making it pander to clicks and likes and all the things that advertising does, which is not necessarily good for real journalists. So you have to straddle this really, really awkward chasm of making things commercially viable so you can pay for good journalists, because they don't come for nothing.
Yeah.
And they often are resource heavy, and particularly when you're doing the investigative stuff that you guys have become so good at, that costs time and money, and there aren't angels just farting money out from heaven. And on the other side, you have this job of trying to be as objective as possible. And I know that you have people who say that you're not, and you have people who say, oh, well, your opinion people are far too much on the right or on the left, and they criticize you guys for all kinds of things. Of course, none of them are running their own publication. But how do you manage to reconcile those complex things in an era where stuff changes so quickly?
Yeah, it's a really difficult situation that we find ourselves in, and that a lot of media find themselves in, because the goals and the incentives of large scale digital media don't always result in quality journalism, you know. And you know, we've seen a couple of a great example of this dichotomy is a legitimate news site in Zimbabwe that runs a fake news site in South Africa to generate enough revenue to pay for the legitimate news in Zimbabwe.
What is it called?
I read it was a Mail and Guardian article, and I have my suspicions around who it is, but I don't. They didn't name the site, because you could then go and sort of work out who it is.
So the fake news pays for the real news.
Correct. And I mean, amazing. If that doesn't tell you almost everything that's wrong with the environment and how the incentives are so misaligned with quality journalism, then I don't know what does, you know. And so it's in that environment that we have to then carve out a space for, like, all these, you know, these really time-consuming, resource-intensive investigations that need to happen, and also the deep analysis that we've become known for as well, which, you know, takes time and effort and isn't reactive and, you know, isn't just, you know, catering to stuff that pops on social media, which is how you know, a lot of people get a lot of page views, is like, you know, what's popular in social media, let's write about it, as opposed to, you know, which is very reactive, doesn't take a lot of, you know, effort.
Why all of a sudden, like, reputable news agencies are suddenly running news headlines based on a tweet.
Correct.
Somebody
yeah.
tweets something.
And then embedding
and
the tweet and then, you know, calling that
you're
an
like,
article.
Well, this is not an article. Yeah. This is just like people's tweets. Are you paying these people to use their tweets?
Yeah. And so, look, and that's fine for some, whatever. But I mean, we don't, that's not our mission. And, you know, we've created a space for journalists who want to participate in the long form stuff that we've become known for. And we make it safe for them. And we tell them we don't even share analytics with them. So, like, that's not important. Like, what's important is to get the story right and to make sure that whoever reads this bit of content or consumes this bit of content is better informed afterwards, you know, so that they can make better decisions. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to do that if you're just sort of rehashing stuff that's been on social media.
You know, so one of the reasons that people keep touting as why media as a whole is declining is because of the cult of personality. So individuals have, because of their point of view, because of the way that they write, all of that stuff is what makes people follow their writing. It's what makes people read what they write. Do you think that as a non-media guy, it made you better at kind of looking out for what an individual had to bring? Also, I mean, I think over the past couple of years, we've seen Daily Maverick get quite a lot of big hitters, quite a lot of big names coming across onto the medium. Do you think being the non-media guy made it easier for you to pick those names?
There's two distinct issues there. The one is obviously the attraction of high quality talent, journalistic talent in this country. Being a non-media guy in this space was both an advantage and a disadvantage at the same time.
But
so
you became a media guy very quickly. I mean, you caught on. It. Media isn't actually not that complicated. It's not full of rocket scientists.
Yeah, I mean, but
you caught on really fast. I mean, you probably made a lot of people quite embarrassed about the fact that they thought they were media experts, and you supposedly had no qualifications in that arena. And you really, between you and Bronco, you kind of make a really good team. You fill a lot of gaps for each other, right?
Yeah, I think that's really the core of our sustainability, was that we had each other to kind of fall back on, and we were sort of multi-talented enough. But we tried to approach every problem in the business, whether it was a content one or an editorial strategy or a hire, was, you know, common sense. We just try to use, you know, made sense, not because what had people done in the past, you know. And so we were kind of, well, there aren't really textbooks for where we're going, so we might as well just write our own. And so we try to approach it, think, okay, what's the smart thing to do here? What's the long-term thing? You know, sometimes joke, we're test cricket as opposed to T20. And, you know, and yes, T20 did have a good influence on test cricket, and but it's made test cricket even better. And I think, that's kind of our philosophy, is that, the longer game is the one that, you know, that really counts, for example.
And how do you choose that talent? Because there are a few really, really amazing people in your stable who, used to work for much more mainstream, and by mainstream I certainly mean no disrespect to outliers like the Maverick, mainstream publications. And I mean, you've also, you've gone through some interesting changes over the years.
Yeah, look, a constant state of change is really, you just have to accept that, you know, that it's always changing all the time. And if you become complacent and comfortable, then, you know, the next disruption is going to hit you in the face if you're not always ready to change. I think in terms of attracting, good talent, it was really just consistency over a long period of time. I mean, the challenge is obviously we've had this perception that we were, 30 days from closing, which was the reality for pretty much 9 of our 10 years. And it's kind of hard to attract talent when people have that.
They're not sure they're going to get paid.
Exactly. And we used to hire people and tell them, say, look, we're doing great things and we're growing and our brand's growing and our numbers are growing. But this could all go tits up, soon. So you've got to know that coming on board. And but I think by the time you sort of get to that stage, people are like, they've believe in the mission. Every month that you go on, they see, okay, another payroll down. Okay, cool. There's some sort of stability. And but people come along for the ride, and I think they know that coming in, and it also allows them, you know, we sell them on the idea that you can come in and you'll be free to do the journalism that you want, that you find meaning in, that gives you purpose, that makes an impact, that isn't limited in terms of the number of words that need to go onto a printed page, or will potentially piss off an advertiser or whoever it is, and we'll squash it. I mean, I don't think we've ever spiked a story ever. And so, you know, we give them that space. And so that goes, well, okay, cool. They're willing to take the risk. And, you know, journos aren't exactly the best at financial planning anyway. So, you know, they jump on board. And as we've grown and as we've sort of become more prominent, more people have sort of gravitated towards us.
So, but the converse of that, the thing about the talent is that also a big problem that the media industry is facing is the credibility of the individuals themselves. And Rebecca did a thing on Maverick Insider about what's now a big story again.
Yes.
With Roxanne.
Yes.
Which is kind
what's,
of...
What's the story?
So the story with Roxanne Joseph is she faked cancer, basically.
What?
Yeah.
She faked having cancer, and then this was quite a thing. You know, it's created a very polarized view in the industry as well. So Rebecca Davis wrote quite a thoughtful kind of insight about the fact that the mental illness that she was suffering at the time, and empathy that people are not giving her the empathy, people are not giving her an opportunity to kind of just deal with all of the stuff that she was dealing with. And then this past week, Eusebius wrote a counter argument in the Mail and Guardian. But what that has called into question is kind of the integrity and credibility of the individuals with whom we are trusting these news stories, and we are trusting with all of the work of journalism. And what Daily Maverick has also often been accused of is that it drives a particular agenda, and the people there are driving a particular agenda, and this is why all of the stories are skewed in a particular way. So how do you balance those things?
So I think, you know, just getting onto Rebecca's piece, I mean, that followed the investigation that the Mail and Guardian did. And then, you know, her commentary was about, you know, whether the investigation was really necessary in that situation when, there were other journalists and other people in the media industry who deserved a closer looking, closer inspection than potentially Roxanne did. But it raised some very interesting questions around rebuilding trust, and when, you know, what do people who abuse our trust for whatever reason, when are they sort of rehabilitated enough to go back, and how do they prove that? You know, and I think that was the gist of Rebecca's thing. And I think, yeah, and we're seeing some other instances now where journalists' credibility is being questioned. And we've seen instances where, you know, for example, the Rogue Unit reporting by the Sunday Times, hasn't really run its full course in terms of, you know, the accountability that needs to happen there. It's difficult. Look, as a publication, the side that we pick, is the one that we believe to be the truth, and that's what we chase. And, we don't try and sort of angle for a particular leaning left or right or a political party or another. It's really just about having enough diverse opinions, having enough strong analysis work and investigations so that we can ultimately form the best and clearest picture of what's going on in this country. And that's our mission as a national publication, is how do we try and capture what's happening in South Africa on any given day. That's, you know, the most important topics that you need to be aware of to know how to navigate a life in this crazy country of ours.
I didn't know about this Roxanne Joseph story. My God, it's right. Harrowing. I mean, like, I had no idea that this was even going on, because I had no idea she existed. You've blown my mind. I've got to go and read all about this now. I'm going to be busy all morning. But Stilly, there are obviously problems with fake news, and we are
people are always going to be suspicious, but they're especially suspicious now of where the information comes from. I mean, I remember that expose that Marianne Tam did of the EFF's rubbish.
Yes.
After their Cape Town visit not so long ago. Yeah. And she got into huge trouble, and there were death threats. And, you know, I saw that here was a journalist who now, just like we hold journalists responsible for fake news, they're also, if they do honest reporting, even if some people consider it to be slightly gonzo, if they do honest reporting, they face very serious repercussions from a safety point of view and other places. This is a different world to the world that journalists used to inhabit. And it takes such courage to be able to, first of all, tell a story, and then to tell it honestly without fear or favor. It's not an easy thing to do. A lot of journalists hold it up as their standard, but very few actually live it.
Yeah, and on that, I mean, to add an extra layer of bravery to that is the fact that most of our investigative journalists are women as well, and they get extra threats and extra stick.
Yeah, and extra misogyny and rape threats, and God knows.
Exactly, and just for being a woman. And so, and in this country where we have such a huge problem with what's going on with gender violence, that makes what they do even more incredible in my mind. And that story especially, she got a backlash from not only supporters of the EFF, but even other media outlets that were questioning her ethics and her practices. And, for me, there's two things. One is she doesn't hang outside the EFF's, get together places all the time to do this. There was a tip off from a member of the public saying, hey, this had gone down, you might want to check it out. And then you go through all the decisions of is this public interest? What is the impact of this? What are we trying to tell the public here? And what can we get from this? So I think, that's an important point. And then, that the other point to make around that particular story was, if that information about what they had bought and how they conducted themselves had been captured in email, for example, and we got those emails and then wrote about it, what's the difference? In fact, it's actually
the Gupta leaks.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the difference?
Exactly. And so, it's actually harder work to kind of go and put yourself in even more physical danger potentially, and to do that work and sift through rubbish and used all sorts of used instruments and things that you found, and to then write a story that was that had an impact like that. So it's every day you've got to make these the really tough decisions, and then unlike many other jobs, you then have to put it out to the world to judge. Right, every day your work is being judged by the entire world. It's mental health is an issue in I think in this day and age anyway, generally. But then also on top of that, as journalists, I think they face extraordinary pressures that people don't maybe don't know, or we haven't told them about. And
so what is so a fly on the wall at the content meeting?
Jesus, no.
Come on,
like those flies.
Come on,
Billy. No, they left. Those flies they can't do that. It's not good for their mental
from trauma.
No, it's mental. Like eventually you got to this place now where they have to have like a stick or something you got to pass around if you want to talk.
A conch.
Because otherwise
really you have a talking stick.
A talking stick. So otherwise you won't get a chance, or it's like it just goes. It's just
who are your longest standing journalists on the staff? Who've been with you guys the longest?
So Brooke Spector was there from the first get-go. Kevin Bloom was on staff as well. Steve Curtis was, and Tim Cohen was. And now Tim, Stephen, and Kevin have all kind of gone and come back. Mm-hmm. So I think of the original staff, it's just Brooks, Branko, and myself, who've been and sort of...
Wow.
And broken run.
Yeah, but the majority, I think there's... two people from the original team who have left, but everyone else has kind of stayed, and we just could add and grow and grow.
And do you have a lot of behind the scenes people who we don't hear about, or is it quite a small, tight staff?
It's for 6 years, I think we had one non-editorial staff member,
full-time
staff member, and that was me. And
So and you did finance, you did marketing, you did
sales,
you did everything, right?
IT project management. Sheesh. It was and I wrote as well, you know.
Yeah, and you got paid nothing sometimes.
Yeah, for a long time. So I started out part time, and then when it became a bigger and bigger thing, then you know I had to make a decision to go full time, and I did. And then it was just, you know, it's just been crazy. But there's a small team sort of behind now that the membership side of things has grown.
Yeah, I want to talk about
and
that.
The technology side has grown. That's got a smaller support team, but still majority, 70% of the staff are editorial.
I was at a talk the other day, a Heavy Chef talk, and Richard Poplack was there as well, and he spoke about the membership thing.
Yes.
And how that's probably, for a lot of people, you know, there's that pop-up that comes up often when I go onto your site about, no, let the journalists go hungry. And, you know, either you can support them and you can make a donation, but now you're actually talking about membership. And Pumi was just talking about the Maverick Insider, which she obviously subscribes to, so she's a member. How's this membership thing going to work?
So we've just finished our first year, and this is our answer to a paywall.
Right.
And it started out as a sort of a, in our minds, how are we going to crack this reader revenue conundrum? And I went on a tour of the States and came back, and I saw that you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post were especially optimistic about the future. And this was about 2 years ago when I went. And the reason being that the Washington Post had a sugar daddy in the form of Jeff Bezos, obviously.
Yeah,
that,
sure.
You know, but they had both also cracked the reader revenue conundrum. And so I came back and I said to Brenger, we've got to do, you know, we've got to figure out reader revenue. And he was like, no, we won't do a paywall, ever, never. So,
by the way, that is exactly what Bronco sounds like. Anybody who hasn't met him.
And I knew he was going to say that. And luckily for us, quite a bit of research had been done into membership models. And I'd find the membership model, and it was like, this is us. This is what we need to do. It was an epiphany moment. And what it is we don't restrict any access to our work, and we're building this community not on the through the access, paying for the access to news, but around the relationship with news.
So it's not just a subscription. You're part of the organism that is the Daily
Maverick. Correct. It's a voluntary membership program, and the core focus, the primary focus of this membership program is to build the community. And if we do that well, there will be some financial benefits to us, but it also means that we have to build this program that engages with our members on a level where we can, you know, they become closer to what we do. We share what's going on with the organization, what we're thinking. We solicit their advice. We ask for feedback. We survey them. We get them involved. We put on events for them. This Friday we're putting on for the first time a webinar with Polly van Wyk, who's going to be talking through the EFF and VBS stuff that she's been working on. And so it's an opportunity for us to solicit questions ahead of time and to then have this live webinar with our members. And they can ask her questions about, you know, how did the story come about? Like, you know, what are the key decisions you made? Or like, how did you get those bank statements? You know? And so it's really just about sharing that news, that relationship around news with people. And it's been hugely successful for us.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned the New York Times, because I made a note this morning about the New York Times and asking you about their model, which I very much enjoy, because I'm part of that community.
Yes.
As well, because mm-hmm. I love the stories, I love the writing, I love everything about it. But I'm also fascinated at how much, I mean, the New York Times is one of the growing ones, mm-hmm. kind of in that digital
yeah.
space, and their editor, good news for you, gets paid on average 115% more than every other editor in the space.
One day, Stilly, from Pumi's lips to God's ears.
But that's because people love it, and people are engaged in it. And I think that's what you've also managed to do with the Daily Maverick. Whether people love it or hate it, people are engaged. And
correct.
That's all you actually really need to do.
Yeah, and it's all underpinned by one thing, quality journalism. And I was at a conference recently where Jessica Levin, she's the founder of The Information, which is a new startup in America. You know, her thing is you can't put a paywall on a pig. You know,
it has to be
can't
great.
Can't polish a turd.
Yeah, exactly. And she says, in fact, it can't only be great. It has to be 10 times better than anything else out there, because that's what's going to get people over the line. Now, membership and our model of membership is slightly different, because we don't restrict access to anything, which actually makes the demands on the quality of the journalism even higher, because we don't have that three articles and you're done barrier. It's like everything's free. So basically, you got to get people over the line in another way. And so we're figuring it out, and we've gone a long way to doing that.
Well, there's a couple of things I'd like to boast about on your behalf. More than 7,000 members joining, and a 75% growth in headcount since you started.
It's 8,000 now.
8,000. Yeah. There are 1.7 million monthly subscribers and 115,000 newsletter subscribers.
2 million visitors to the website in a month now, yeah.
You're bringing out a 10-year anniversary book called We Have a Game Changer, A Decade of Daily Maverick.
Yep.
Which will be available for purchase, but it'll be online for free.
Correct. Yeah.
And you're hoping it'll be the first book of the publishing imprint Maverick 451. And then you've got this is an award which I think deserves a whole lot of credit, the Scorpio, Daily Maverick Scorpio, which is your investigative unit. Amabungani and News 24, in cooperation with Open Up and Finance Uncovered, have scooped the Global Gong for Investigative Journalism. The team was announced as co-winners of the Global Shining Light Award of the Global Investigative Journalism Network, the world's most prestigious investigative journalism award, just a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Bloody well done.
Thank you.
Wow. Thanks. Wow, that's tremendous.
Yeah, it's been a huge year for us in terms of growth, in terms of rolling out new editorial sections and projects, and obviously also, you know, getting the Maverick Insider program up and running, which is also being celebrated and touted as one of the, you know, top five membership programs in the world, which we're also incredibly proud of, and that also recently won an award as well. So it's been a big year, it's been a crazy year, and you know, looking at the next 12 months, unfortunately, it's not going to be any less crazy for us. So we're just going to just keep doing what we're doing.
Yeah, y'all are like, you're reporting on what's happening in this country of all the countries in the world. It's crazy. Like, well, every single day, well, it's crazy. The news cycle here.
It might be time for us to get people talking again about podcasts, of things that you already do. I know you're doing your own podcasts as well, but it is time for us to kick that into gear again, because it was one of the most popular shows that we did when we started off here at CliffCentral.com, and people were very pissed off when it stopped. So maybe it's time to get that going. I know the New York Times have got a very successful model there too.
Yeah, 1 billion downloads it just hit a couple weeks ago, which is incredible.
Amazing. So, Stilly, thank you. Very good to see you, and appreciate you popping in to visit us. I know lots of people who listen to us subscribe to the Maverick and vice versa, so it's good to keep digital media at the forefront of what we're up to and what we care about and what we're paying attention to.
And congrats to you guys as well. I mean, you know, not only sticking around, but also continuing to pioneer and to, you know, break new ground in this space. I mean, if anyone knows how hard it is, it's us.
We're only 5 years old. You're 10 years old. Does it get better?
Okay.
He's shaking his head. He's shaking his head both ways. I don't know what to
write. Okay. Right.
We're in glorious times now.
You know, it's fine, and the pain can be rewarding sometimes. So, you know, stick with it, guys. You know, there's sometimes the rewards aren't always financial, but they, you know, it's special, and you do get to work in a creative environment every day. So, you know, I'm forever grateful for that.
Ugh, that sounds like shit.
It makes it sound like an abusive relationship.
How do you eat creativity, goddammit? I can't eat creativity. No.
Yeah,
no.
Just lose weight. Summer body loading.
Well done. All right, thanks very much, Stilly, and happy birthday to the Daily Maverick this year, in this month. All right, coming up, we've got How's It China Episode 4, where we talk about South Africans who are living in China. We get to talk to some very interesting people who popped into the studio this morning. We're going to ask them all about the lifestyle, karaoke, nightlife, socializing in Chinese, you know, speaking to Chinese people, eating the food, doing the thing, what experiences in China have shocked them and which ones have made them feel at home, all of that kind of thing, and a whole lot more in episode 4 of How's It China. But first, it is time for another of our award-winning blind history episodes. This one, Queen Victoria, Pumi. Once the Empress of one-fifth of the world's surface.
Yes, Gareth. Yes, and also one half of that V&A.
That's right, yeah. So her name's all over there. There's a statue of her outside the Pietermaritzburg City Hall, for heaven's sake. So she's
Victoria.
Not, she's not such a part of distant history that we don't know who she is. But here it is, Blind History. This is season 2 of Blind History and Queen Victoria featuring today.
In the year 1900, during an age of unprecedented scientific, military, and industrial change, the largest empire in the world, an empire upon which it was said the sun never set, was at its zenith. The whole of Canada, Australia, India, South Africa, and some 200 other territories were the great realm of one person. A queen and empress in whose name one quarter of the world's population were ruled. A depressed and rheumatic little woman of 5 foot, dressed only in black, wandered the small rooms of her private apartments at Windsor Castle, disconnected from everyone except an Indian servant and her doctor, and still in mourning for her beloved husband Albert. This was Alexandrina von Sachs-Coburg-Gotha, known to the world and to history as Victoria.
She was the empress of the world's greatest empire. Her name denotes an entire era of British history, Queen Victoria.
Hmm. How do you feel about Queen Victoria? Because I get the sense you weren't as enthusiastic about her as some of the other people we've spoken of.
You know, if I look at a lot of the people we've been looking at and talking about, and, you know, there's a lot of them are warriors and they've created something serious or they've changed the course of history. Well, I felt she did pretty much nothing. She mourned half her life. And the other half of the life, she bitched her prime ministers. So I'm not convinced, Gareth.
Well, let me try and convince you. She had the second longest reign in British history. The only person to surpass her is the current queen, Elizabeth II. Her father was Prince Edward, the Duke of Kent, who was the fourth son of King George III, who, of course, went mad. She wasn't expected to be queen. Her father was far down the line of succession at the beginning. And then, ultimately, it fell to her. There was a bit of a succession crisis because the only heir had died, and suddenly it looked like Victoria's father had to produce a child. So he quickly found this German princess, whose name was also Victoria, and they had a kid some months later. She became the empress of the, what, one quarter of the world's surface at one point?
Yeah, she was fifth in line.
At the beginning, yeah. It was said that when Victoria was queen, the sun never set on the British Empire. At some point, there was always sun on some part of the British Empire. I mean, that's enormous. It is the largest geographical and territorial piece of earth ever owned by one person. And remember, it is owned by the sovereign. And it continues to be the largest.
That's fair enough, but I think she was in seclusion after Albert's death, so I don't think she saw anywhere the sunset.
Well, look,
sunset.
She had a bit of a bizarre childhood, and I'm not going to be her advocate here, but I'll try and explain it to you like this. Her mother was a bit of a crackpot. Her dad died when she was one. Her mother loved her intensely and wouldn't let her out of her sight. She was very careful to keep her within the confines of her mother's proximity, didn't introduce her to any dodgy people. I mean, some of her uncles were the most unbelievably badly behaved people in human history. They had mistresses and illegitimate children and wild parties and drank too much and ate too much. And so I think the Duchess of Kent tried to keep Victoria safe. As a result, until her 18th birthday, she basically slept in the same bedroom as her mother for all of her time as a minor. She had a dog called Dash, who was a spaniel, who was her real only friend besides her mom growing up. So she grew up in complete seclusion. And as a result, you know, every man she met, she fell in love with, including her first Prime Minister, Melbourne. She took over at 18. She was crowned, and he was her first prime minister, and he also sort of was a father figure to her in some ways. And she was absolutely inconsolate when he was voted out and Peel was voted in. She didn't like any of her prime ministers after that except Disraeli. And she did struggle to have real relationships with men, although there are stories now about many of the men that she had during her life potentially being romantic interests of hers. Of course, the most famous one was her husband, Albert, who was a German prince. She said some very nice things about him. Let me read this. This is when they first met. She said, "Albert is extremely handsome. His hair is about the same color as mine. His eyes are large and blue, and he has a beautiful nose and a very sweet mouth with fine teeth. But the charm of his countenance is his expression, which is most delightful." Another man who her uncle wanted her to marry, Alexander of the Netherlands, "on the other hand," she described as "very plain." So she really did love him, and they were together for a long time, produced 9 children.
Yeah, that's incredible. So she was pregnant for a long time. But yeah. Albert, I mean, that was...
She was pretty much pregnant the whole time they were together and married.
But Albert was studious, and he just worked himself to death.
Albert was actually a very clever man, and that was rare in the aristocracy, because most of them were quite lazy or eccentric or murderous. And he was an engineer, or a wannabe engineer, and a wannabe architect, and a wannabe scientist, and a wannabe inventor. And he put on the Great Exhibition and did much to forge Britain's place in the world as a scientific, industrial, and technical leader. And really, during her life, I think you could say that there was so much change in the military, the scientific, and the engineering world that much of that must have been brought on by Albert. And she was hopelessly devoted to him. Their 9 children ended up producing children who would rule all of Europe. And she had the slight misfortune of seeing in her latter years, and obviously in her children's reigns, just the fighting of cousin upon cousin and the destruction of all these ancient empires. And even the haemophilia, which was carried through her genes to the Romanovs and others. But effectively, her eldest grandson, Kaiser Wilhelm II, would be head-to-head against her own son, Edward VII, and then later on George V, in World War I.
But just going a little bit back now, because maybe I'm being a bit unfair, but what I really saw as her finest time that I can see in looking at her was when she was 18. She was woken up at 6 a.m. in the morning by the Privy Council, who came to tell her that her uncle, the king, had passed away, and she was now queen. She did not call her mom. She did everything on her own. She sat in a high chair around these tall men. She was not intimidated. She remained calm. She knew her place. She knew that she was queen, and she knew what she wanted to do. She was very strong. She was iron-willed, and that gives a little bit of insight into the relationship with her mom.
Yeah.
Because her mom and...
Sir John Conroy.
They were in cahoots, and to a certain extent, driving towards becoming regent before she turned 18, and even trying to change the majority to force her to only being able to come to the throne when she was 21. So she banished her mom to the other side of the castle and kicked old
Sir John Conroy
as far as possible. He obviously tried to make a comeback here and there.
Yeah.
But and that was very, very impressive. That was
I mean, for an 18-year-old,
that was incredible.
Especially one who was as sheltered as she was.
Exactly, yeah.
Privately, she was very much a family person. She and Albert, with all their children, were a tight-knit family. She did exercise quite a lot of political influence on her prime ministers, and she tried to involve herself in politics in a way that most modern monarchs wouldn't. She had dynastic ambition. She definitely wanted to see her children and her grandchildren well-placed in society. But publicly, she gave off this air of morality and strictness, you know, standards, and wanted to be perceived as a national icon. Now, of course, all of that came crashing down when her husband died. He died in 1861, and she just disappeared. She went into mourning, wore black for the rest of her life, lived only at Windsor, Balmoral, and the Isle of Wight, Osborne House, was hardly ever seen by her people. I think she made an appearance a few years later at her, first of all, Golden and then Diamond Jubilee, and they were just ecstatic because the Republican movement gained quite a lot of ground while she was quiet. I mean, when there's no king at home or no queen at home, people tend to behave badly. And there was even someone who posted a notice on Windsor Castle saying, this place is up for sale. They're going out of business.
But I think Disraeli got it out of sort of out of seclusion. And also her gardener or horseman, Tom Brown.
Well, this is interesting.
The people
for her time
hated it.
For her time, she was an incredibly open-minded woman. She was very into multiculturalism. So she had one or two interesting things. I mean, you mentioned Disraeli. He was the first ever Jewish prime minister and Sephardic Moroccan Jew to boot, which was quite extraordinary for the time. There was still a lot of anti-Semitism around. She had her mufti, who she loved, her munshi, sorry. His name was Abdul Karim, who taught her Urdu. And she learned that late in her life. And when her prime minister and a lot of her advisors and her son tried to get rid of the munshi, she got quite upset with them and called them all racists. So, I mean, this was in the late 1800s, early 1900s. She also had John Brown, who was a Scottish man who looked after her in her dotage and kind of brought her a little bit out of mourning because she hadn't had any other male influences in her life at that point. She was really only dealing with the business of government and managing her own family. And John Brown was this gruff Scottish man who had grown up in the Highlands and would take her on long walks and force her to get on and off of her horse on her own. And, you know, he used to say, "Come on, women." He'd talk to her like that, and she wasn't sure how to deal with this.
Yeah, that's right. He did talk very rapidly.
She was so used to being deferred to.
And the British public hated John Brown.
Well, I don't know if they did, because they were poisoned against him by her immediate circle, who thought it was inappropriate for her to have such a close relationship with him. In fact, when she was buried, she had a lock of his hair and a picture of him in her hand, and it was disguised under a bouquet of flowers so that her family wouldn't see it.
Sure, that's incredible.
Yeah, it was one of her last wishes. So she had a very close relationship with him.
But she went deeper into mourning again because his brother murdered him.
Yeah, and she was sick at the time. He was meant to be looking after her. And it just didn't go well. The poor woman was surrounded by tragedy. So I suppose you've got to be a little bit more forgiving.
No, I am. I was being a bit facetious. Look, she did. It was an incredible era. It's called the Victorian era.
Yeah.
If we look at her children and her grandchildren, the grandmama of Europe.
Yeah. She was also, in some ways, quite traditional. We mentioned earlier the morality and the strictness, but she didn't like the idea of votes for women. She thought that was a very bad idea. She liked being a woman. She liked being treated like a woman. She told Disraeli, "Flattery always helps you, but with royalty, you should put it on with ladles. So you should use an excess of flattery." She didn't like Russell. She didn't like Gladstone. She thought he was very boring and not particularly fond of Peel, but she got involved in all the events of her time, the Irish potato famine, the war in the Crimea, the Indian situation. She was the first Empress of India.
Correct.
And she was beloved by the Indians at that
Disraeli
point.
Disraeli, actually, I think he promoted her.
Yeah, he arranged for her to be called Empress. She quite liked that title too. And by the age of 81, when she eventually died, she had very bad rheumatism. She was blind mostly because of cataracts. And she had been a very studious and worldly human being during her life. She'd recorded almost everything in a set of diaries. Wrote 2,500 words a day on all of her experiences. So we had a chronicle. And her youngest daughter, Beatrice, then transcribed all of that and burnt the originals, unfortunately.
But I think she also doctored it a bit.
She did. She would have left out stuff. The John Brown stuff and the Munshi and all that kind of thing, because I think the Queen was quite devoted to those people. And perhaps even some of the stuff around her arguments with her son, Edward VII, because she blamed him for Albert's death because he was a philanderer and he was a bit of a man about town. He used to be badly behaved and didn't exactly bring glory onto the monarchy.
And then I think Albert went to go see him. Albert was very sick. I think nowadays they're trying to think possibly he had stomach cancer.
He died of diphtheria, but it could well have been because at that stage they didn't know how to diagnose these things.
But 2 weeks prior to his death, he went to Cambridge to meet Bertie. And
to upbraid him.
Yeah, to bring him into line. And they had to walk. They walked for hours in the rain. And Queen Victoria said, no, this is that,
that's the cause.
That was the cause of it. But she had, funny enough, the German side of it was incredible, that Albert and Queen Victoria spoke German to each other, right, especially in private conversations, and they had to work quite hard to get the German accent out of Victoria.
Yes, well, the Hanoverians were famously German. The first two kings only spoke German, and then by George III, he learned to speak English. But there we go, Queen Victoria. Hopefully you like her a little more than Anthony did at the beginning of this discussion. Thank you for listening to Season 2 of Blind History. This is one of the many episodes that we have planned for you, and there are plenty more to come. It's brought to you by Tailored Blinds and Shutters, only on CliffCentral.com. CliffCentral.com.